Welcome back to the Wizards of Ecom podcast. This is episode number 248. My name is Carlos Alvarez, and I'll be your host for the show. On today's episode, we have Nathaniel Vasquez, founder of Pipsticks, a killer subscription box brand started as just a sticker club and has grown into a massive company, crushing it in the subscription box space. Welcome to the show, Nathaniel.
Yeah, thanks, Carlos. It's a pleasure to be here. I look forward to it.
I've told everybody a bunch of info. I think I said this when we spoke prior, but I get people that come up to me a lot in my community and will show me this idea that they have to start selling stickers online. And I'm almost ashamed to admit, I say, don't do it. Sticker Mule's got that whole thing cornered. There's no room in the sticker world. Like you can't make money selling stickers, right?
Yeah.
I think I'm wrong.
I mean, I guess I wouldn't be here if you were right, but I would also give everybody the same advice. Please don't start a sticker company. There's plenty of us out there right now. We'll do just fine without you.
can you talk about some of the origins of this company with Pipsticks? Like, you have a very unique niche, and how you explained it to me prior on how it was selected. I thought it made me go out there and get some. So like, I'd love the audience to be able to hear it from you.
Yeah, sure. So, my wife started the company, I guess it was, eight or nine years ago. And she was a stay at home mom at the time, graphic designer, and wanted to do something part-time, you know, a little side gig to keep her skills going so that when the kids were in school, she'd have a nice clean path back to work and she wouldn't have to, you know, have a bit of a gap in between. And she had always sort of wanted to be an entrepreneur, was a serial entrepreneur, had ideas, never really gotten anywhere with them. And this one, you know, we were, I don't know, sitting at dinner one night and she talked about it. And normally I'd say, no, that doesn't work. She called me the killer of ideas. And on this one, the numbers kind of made sense. And I said, let's go for it. And the reason she had thought of it was she had received, I don't know if you know what, a chain mail sort of a, you know, pyramid scheme chain mail thing is. We got a letter in the mail from one of her friends and it had like three, you know, crappy little sticker sheets in them. And it said, you know, if you send this letter to 25 of your friends, they're gonna, and send them stickers, each of them are gonna send stickers back to you and it's gonna balloon up and you're gonna get all these free stickers in the mail. I think I described that poorly, but it's basically a Ponzi scheme for sticker mail. And she diligently did it and wrote 25 letters to, you know, all of her friends. And 3 months later, you know, like one person sent back like three little crappy sheets of stickers. And our kids were incredibly excited and she was incredibly excited and couldn't get enough of it. So she thought, you know, that she'd go out and look to see if there was a sticker subscription. This was kind of, you know, around the time when Harry's, you know, Dollar Shave Club, all the subscriptions were taking off. And she could not find one. So she decided that she would start one. I was still in finance. I worked for a bank. I had worked there for almost 15 years. And I had no intention of, you know, leaving the bank. But she started this business, got it up and running. After the first year or so, I was at a natural point of leaving the job I was at, looking for another one. We decided to move out of the city for a little while. And I helped her out for a little bit and thought to myself, well, I helped her out for a couple months and maybe another month and then another month. And we got to the end of the year. And I said, actually, this kind of makes sense. Maybe I'll set myself a target for the next year. And if that works out, we'll keep going. And I sort of set those targets every year. And now I've been running a sticker company for 8 years. So nobody would have expected that, me, least of which, but that's where we ended up.
That is insane. And a bank would be the last place I would imagine you see stickers. So like,
there's not a lot of stickers on the trading floor. If you put the Hello Kitty or the giant puffy heart on your monitor, your colleagues will definitely point and laugh on the where I was working at a bank.
When we last spoke, stickers was like very top of mind after the conversation. So it's one of those, there's a word for it, but if you see this car you've never seen before, for me one time it was a red Cadillac and you get it and now all of a sudden you see these, you've never seen it before, but now you see red Cadillacs everywhere. But with the stickers, I went to grab a cup of coffee after we spoke and I was just waiting for my coffee. I look at everybody's computers and like literally every single person in that packed coffee shop had their front of their computer canvassed with stickers. And I was like, wow, like what does this say about the person that that has those stickers. And I feel, I don't know them, but I was like, oh, heavy metal right there. Like, you know, like this person's a little wild. How did you go about picking, deciding on this was the niche of the stickers that you were going to do? And does that represent the people that buy your stickers?
Yeah, for sure. You're right. It's the laptops, it's the water bottles, and it's the backs of everybody's cell phones. And everybody does it. It's a way of, I mean, it's like fashion in a sense. It's a way of representing. It's an accessory. It's a way of telling somebody, you know, who you voted for, or what your favorite music is, or what brands you like, or, you know, what artists you like. Absolutely. That's what people use it for. You know, we chose this brand. I mean, I don't know how many of your listeners can actually see me. I got a big gray beard here, and I'm a guy wearing like a gray and blue flannel shirt. I am not the Pipsticks brand. I mean, I could not be more off brand if you could possibly imagine it. So I really had nothing to do with the choice of what the brand aesthetic was. That was all my wife. She's the face of the brand. She's the voice of the brand. She is, you know, in very small stationary circles, I would say, you know, in air quotes, sticker famous. So she's the reason behind the brand. You know, she's a child of the 80s, liked Lisa Frank, liked Care Bears, you know, liked all the stickers of the 80s, the Miss Grossmans. And that's what she wanted to recreate. You know, she started it as a brand for children. And we recognized very, very quickly afterwards that, you know, most of our customers were not children. I mean, they were not even the parents for children. They were buying them for themselves. So it was this cohort of 20 to 50 year old women who were into scrapbooking, planners, journals, stationery, notebooking. They wanted beautiful, happy pink, you know, stickers. I would say in many ways, you know, we sell stickers, but we don't sell stickers. We sell happiness, right? So that was what the brand was. And she really started. If it was me, it'd be, I don't know, whiskey and axes and you know, and shaved carved ice or something weird like that. But this was definitely her brand. I couldn't be more off brand, but it works out well. She's the face of the brand, and I do all the other, you know, the numbers in the back end.
I think the back of you and I's computer would look very similar.
Yeah, the back of my computer is basically just black. There's not much on it. Yeah.
Isn't that wild though, that somebody would spend, it's depending on the computer, but like thousands of dollars on this laptop and then slap stickers on it?
You know, I mean, it's a way of expression, right? I mean, I would say not putting a sticker on your laptop is expressing a statement just as strongly as putting something is on. So I certainly don't begrudge them the decision. You can always peel it off and put something else on. So, you know, go ahead, tell the world what you like.
Yeah, a lot of my online successes have come from selling brands on Amazon. So when we first spoke, I brought up Amazon, and you rightfully immediately pointed out, you know, $6 stickers, I think you said, but like $6 stickers on Amazon would not go well, right?
They did not go well. Yeah.
They did not go well. Yeah. Yeah.
No. Yeah. And so, it was silly. The fees are, of course, it doesn't work. Yeah. A small price ticket products, you know, even with the small and light stuff, don't work very well on Amazon for sure.
Right. Absolutely. However, off Amazon, it's not like it gets cheaper. Like there's almost this thing, like if you have a Shopify site, you know, and you're selling something that is below $25 and does not have a high LTV or something like that, that you're just asking for trouble. So like, how did you make that work?
Well, I mean, so there's two bits to that story, right? And the number one is initially we sold subscriptions, right? So the subscriptions are a recurring monthly purchase. And it's not one sticker, it's 10 or 15 sticker sheets. So it's a higher price point. I think $18 a month is our standard one. And we've got a license deal with Hello Kitty. And that's a $25 a month. And then we sell a stationery box that's, you know, at least twice as much as that. But initially it was just the stickers. And when it's a subscription, it works fine. You can be very aggressive on how you deal with the shipping, and you produce things in bulk, and the margin is fine. The margin's good. The total dollars are small. But then as we started adding on, you know, other than subscriptions, we started as a subscription only. As we started adding on the individual stickers that were in the subscriptions, you know, you go to Amazon, when you buy four things, rarely are all four of those things from the same merchant, right? You're buying a pair of shoes, and you're buying maybe socks, probably from somebody else. And then you buy, I don't know, a toilet paper. It's completely disparate vendors. But if you come to our website, sure, it's a $3 sticker or a $5 sticker, but the average person's spending $30, $35 because they're buying their 10 sets of stickers. So, you know, even though the individual prices are low, the margins on those individual stickers work. And because I know that the AOV is going to be high enough, it works nicely.
And I believe the introduction on who put us together was Josh Roman. Is that
John,
right?
From at BattleBox.
John at BattleBox.
Yeah. Great guy.
Yeah. He seemed to be gung ho, as like all in on subscription boxes and nothing but subscription boxes. And it seems like you started taking a different path on that.
Yeah. I think, you know, subscription boxes are fantastic. It's where we got our start. And a company like BattleBox, they're killing it at subscription boxes. You know, it's working very well for them. But we got to a point, I think, much because of what you're talking about. The price points are very low. You know, we had all these people, these thousands and thousands and thousands of people, or tens of thousands of people who love their stickers. And once a month, I sent them stickers. And you know, the other 29 or 30 days of the month, there was nothing they could buy from me. So we said, you know, we've got this list. Anytime we email somebody, they do this stuff. They love us. They love Mo. They love the brand. But all I'm doing is selling them a pack of stickers once a month. And maybe they buy the kids and they buy the adults. Maybe they can buy two packs of stickers every month. But they have appetite and they trust Mo and they trust the brand. So I better find some other way to sell them something else. So, you know, the subscription tends to be our top of funnel purchase. Although, you know, sometimes we'll get sort of a loss leader or a single sticker or something. But usually subscription is top of funnel. We bring them into the club. We, you know, nurture them. They get all the fun emails, all the community aspects of it. You know, they love the brand. They learn to love the community. And then we, you know, hit them on the back end with all sorts of emails for other offers. Come to our store, check out the stationery book that we've just done. Look at our sticker keeper. You know, here's a bunch of puppy stickers that you can't get. So we really do, by moving past just subscriptions, we've been able to, you know, not increase the AOV of the purchase, but increase the LTV of the customer by bringing them back over and over again and keeping them more engaged.
And where does, if you can share, where is the number one channel for you to get new clients?
Top of funnel, it's Facebook. It's always Facebook. You know, there's, I'd say from paid, Facebook is probably 80%, and AdWords is 20%. I think that's very much a function of your product. You know, if I was a plumber, people wouldn't be finding me on Facebook. They'd be finding me on AdWords because they'd be searching, you know, leaky, you know, flood in the basement. So we do some on AdWords, but it's Facebook is definitely the number one top of funnel channel for sure.
And with all of the apocalypse, you know, doomsday stuff that was going on with the iOS update around Facebook ads, how did that impact you, if at all?
That sucked. I mean, every month Facebook ads are more expensive, you know, last month, no exception. It was hard. It was difficult. We had to change aggressively the way we looked at CPAs and the way we looked at return. So Facebook pre iOS apocalypse, we were able to look at an individual ad set and say, you know, was this returning positive? Did I get a subscription? Did I not get a subscription? All that information sort of vanished, and Facebook became worse at their job with iOS. So we had to really pull back and start looking at things at a much larger holistic level. So now I look at my, you know, my blended new customer CPA. So I say, how many new customers purchased from me this month who have never bought anything before? And how much money did I spend on advertisement? That much. You know, I do that math. I divide those and I say, what is my cost per new customer? So everything I spend on Facebook, everything I spend on AdWords, anything I might spend trying to get TikTok to work or Pinterest or whatever it is, divide that by people who have purchased for the first time this month. And that's my blended new customer CPA. Then I look at my cohort data and I say, you know, let's say my blended new customer CPA was X in January. And then I look at, you know, what the cohort revenue of each of those people were. So in the first month they spent, you know, I don't know, $30. In the second month they spent another $5. Then they spent another $5, whatever those numbers look like. And you have to very, very carefully understand how long it takes you to get a return on your ad spend. And for us, the amount that people spend on any given month is small, but they'll last, you know, well past 2 years. So we have to be willing to accept a 2, 3, 4 month, you know, negative cash flow on those ads in order to make money on month 5, 6, 7 onto, you know, 24 and 30.
Is there Facebook's your largest generator of traffic, but is there another one that's more profitable, but obviously not the largest generator that you're like, I wish this one was doing as much as Facebook?
Yeah, so I mean, I would differentiate between top of funnel traffic, cold traffic, right? Facebook is by far our best and our most efficient. Well, okay, branded search on Google, sure, that's by far the most cost efficient, way to bring people in. But beyond that, but you can use, there's only so much volume there. It's Facebook. But in terms of total traffic, it's our email list, and we cultivate and nurture and maintain a big email list, and that's how we bring everybody back. But we very explicitly, are not targeting people on our email list in, probably 80-90% of our ad spend, just to make sure that we're not doubling up that way. So, email is certainly the best converting, but Facebook is the one that brings us in the most cold traffic that then, turns into new customers.
One of the advantages I feel of like having a being able to see each other, air quotes here, see each other on a Zoom while we record an audio podcast is like you get to see some, like, I guess a little bit of body language. So I
Sure.
feel like when you said TikTok, so many people pound me with TikTok. Oh my God, you're not doing TikTok and TikTok, TikTok. But yet I don't know anyone that is actually crushing it with money in the bank on TikTok. They're followers, right? And I feel like your body language, how you moved when you mentioned TikTok, is it doing anything for you?
No, it's not. We try it and then we turn it off. Then we try it and we turn it off. I think the people where it works are the people who have figured out how to make it organically work. And then the ad, the TikTok algorithms kind of follow from there. So if you have a killer organic, brand presence on TikTok, maybe you can do something that we can't do. But I mean, our brand seems like it should fit TikTok, and it seems like it should fit Pinterest. And whether it's the reach, whether it's the behavior of the people, whether it's the algorithms, I've never found really any success in anything paid other than Facebook and AdWords.
So I'm understanding email to be the central nervous system of your business, right? Because
That's
it's
right. We
something good, right? What do
send
you
a ton
use?
of emails. We use Klaviyo.
Okay, that is amazing. That's the one that I have no. I've done ConvertKit. I've done ActiveCampaign, HubSpot, where I'm at now,
Yeah,
but.
so we started with MailChimp, and we sort of grew out of it, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And we switched to Klaviyo because it was the hot, sexy new thing on the block that everybody recommended. It absolutely does what we need it to do, no questions. And anytime I get someone to tell me I should switch, I look at it, and they'll give me the price difference. And, it probably would be more affordable, but if I look at the cost of, messing this up on two or three emails, and we send out all sorts of emails, even though there are probably other systems that may be better, although I haven't tried them, there are definitely systems that are cheaper. I'm just scared of that risk. So we stick with what we know because we know it works.
They all promise pain-free migrations, and I say they don't exist.
I don't think that exists. No. We've
It's
migrated various systems in the past. No system we've ever migrated has been pain-free, ever.
for people listening to this that may wanna, you have a lot of experience with subscription boxes. For somebody that is thinking that it might be a good idea in their business, what would be some advice that you could give them?
About how to start or how to use them or just in general, huh?
Man, you could run the whole gamut on that one, but yeah, getting started, the idea, how about it? Like, I when I spoke to BattleBox, I was like, this makes all the sense in the world. Like, I totally see how this can happen. I would have bet money you couldn't have done it with stickers though. So like, I'm way off. Like, I'm not connecting. So like, how do you know if an idea is good enough to be a subscription box, or what is enough to make a subscription box?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to depend a huge part in what you're selling, what the cost of that and sort of the MOQs are there and why you're selling it, right? If you're selling, well, look at like Dollar Shave Club, right? If you're selling razor blades, you can produce as many razor blades as you want. You can sell them on your website. You can sell them as a subscription. Why wouldn't you sell them as a subscription? There's no reason not to, right? That's a replenishment model, and you've got that inventory. I would say is if you can get 50 people to buy them every month, as long as it pays for your tech costs, you might as well do it. With something like stickers, different, right? It's not a replenishment model. It's a curation model and a sort of community model. So the stickers that we send out every month are different. They're new, right? And it costs me money to have designers and illustrators create those. We have to print those. I have to reach MOQs in China. We have to ship them in every single month. So there's a lot of fixed costs. So I think the first thing you need to do is you need to look at your cost structure and understand just exactly how much money, you know, you need to make. And that's going to be wildly different for every different product that you have. And then whether or not you should do it, just send out an email. You're going to start with the people you know, right? So if you've got an existing brand, just reach out and ask people how many you're going to join, you know, and see the numbers that come back. You know, take those numbers, you know, cut them by at least 70%, 80% and see what you got left. And if you're anywhere near there, you know, give it a shot, I would say. But the number one factor of whether or not you should do a subscription is just going to be the economics of the product and shipping it out. Because once you've passed that hurdle, then it's just nice, friendly, consistent, low volatility revenue that smooths out your revenue for the course of the year.
I appreciate you sharing how you guys got started with the boxes, subscription boxes. It was more of a, I'm going to say, an accident and curiosity. Once you began, has there been any that you would recommend, resources or courses or mentors that you got along the way that helped you build out the subscription box side of things that you'd recommend?
Yeah. So we're part of SUBTA, the Subscription Box Trade Association. And they put on a show every year called Sub Summit. That's where I met John, right? And that's where I met a ton of other subscription box owners. And that was great. I've gone to that probably for the past 6 or 7 years, attend that one every year. I think that's probably the single biggest resource. You know, it's a normal show. You go, there's speakers, vendors, you know, a community, and that's been super, super valuable. So I would recommend to anybody who's thinking about it, you know, go check out Sub Summit. I swear that wasn't a paid pitch. That's the one that's been good for me. It's where I've met a ton of other business owners, entrepreneurs, and you know, you can have those conversations and figure out what works for everybody.
I'll put your affiliate link in the show notes for that.
Yeah, I'll have to go get one first. Thank you.
How was COVID for the business?
COVID was initially terrifying, like it was for everybody else. We at the time had the subscription going strong. We were developed in our non-subscription capacity. We had a small brick and mortar store that we had to have because of the warehouse was zoned commercial retail. We had a joint venture with a publisher called Workman Publishing. It's not been purchased, but they're out of New York, where we were doing planners. And we had just launched our B2B, our wholesale business. We had these like five different arms to our business. We had to shut down the brick and mortar store. So that went to zero immediately. Wasn't a big percentage, but it was something. The publisher deal that we had, these were dated planners. And when you sell a dated planner to somebody like Barnes and Noble, because it's got a date on it, they reserve the right to make you take them all back on January 1. They're not sold. So essentially that business got just annihilated. I mean, we lost a ton of money. It was a joint venture with the publisher. So they shared in the loss. But, you know, so the brick and mortar went to zero. The JV with the planners, the dated planners and journals, that lost a ton of money. The B2B side of the business was just getting started. Could not have been a worse possible time to start a business. So that went straight to zero. So all the money we'd spent in the prior year and a half getting that built up to launch. I mean, the launch was our hard launch. Our soft launch was like a day before COVID. It was bad timing. And that left the subscriptions and the online business. And for the first month or two months, when the world didn't know what was happening, everything was kind of slow, but okay, not disastrous. We thought maybe this was going to be the end of it. And then by, what was it, May or June, I forget the dates, where everybody decided that, you know, it was not a good thing, but everybody was going to be okay. And they had money to spend and they need to be in their houses. Then it was great. And we grew that year, despite having lost in all those other parts of the business, the subscription and the e-com, you know, made enough to make up for that. So, I mean, one thing I could impart to anybody is absolutely have as many possible different ways of selling your products to as many different people as possible. Because any one of those parts of the business would have sunk us if we didn't have all of them together to make up. And there's been other times where, you know, the B2B starts doing better, even though the subscriptions are tailing off. Like right now we're having a, you know, rougher time with Facebook. So our inbound subscription numbers are a lot less, our new subs every month than they have been for the prior year. And that's painful, but the B2B, you know, has started to pick up a little bit. So, you know, diversify across those channels as much as you can, because it is not always rosy everywhere.
Do you foresee an exit? Like, is an exit something that you guys would be
You
open
know, we're,
to?
we don't have a plan for an exit. You know, I'm not somebody who, I don't like the VC model of spend $1 billion to grow your company non-profitably to unbelievably large sizes so you can sell it like a unicorn. Not that I can see it, you know, a $2 billion unicorn, sticker unicorn. I believe much more in the model of build a good business, make it a solid business, be smart about it along the way. Don't look to sell it. And, you know, who knows? Maybe, you know, maybe 2, 3, 5, 10 years from now, somebody comes in and there's a great offer. I'm not gonna say no if somebody has, you know, somebody puts a Godfather offer in front of you. You know, who's gonna say no? But no, we don't have any intention or motivation right now to sell it.
Okay. I think that's the secret to selling your business, by the way, is focus on the numbers, high quality product, amazing customer service, you know, just keep your nose down. And I think that is the only tried and true method for successfully selling your business. So I'm going to take
Yeah,
that as a strong yes.
I tend to agree. I tend to agree, but that's not our goal. That's not our goal.
I wanted to ask a question, and I also want to be respectful of your time, but when we were talking about email, I'm a bit of an email geek. So do you have us, and I think, I don't know if this is your department, but like, is there one or two flows that you have within your email that you're like, this is our gold mine flow right here. Like, we make the majority of our money, not money, our profits, however you want to do it, off this flow.
You mean like the transactional, like the abandoned carts, that kind of stuff, or do you mean or anything?
Sure. Is it your welcome email? Do you have a, you know, limited time offer blast? Is it abandoned
It is.
carts?
Yeah. I mean, we've got all that. We've got the abandoned carts, and we've got the, you know, the cancellation flows and the welcome flows. But I really think it's the combination of all those things together, right? So we have Throwback Thursdays and Fan Mail Fridays, which are content driven. So sure, there's might be a discount at the end or an offer, but you know, there's at least two emails a week that are just content, just to get people excited about the brand. So you know, I see the email like the subscription as a way of getting people excited about the product, of getting people excited about my wife, about Mo, getting excited about stickers, sharing with them, making them feel like they're part of a community. You know, we'll speak at a conference or a convention, a stationery planner convention, and people come up to her as though they're her best friend, right? I mean, you may have seen things like this before on the podcast. People who listen to you, when you're in somebody's ear for, you know, an hour or 2 hours, wherever it is, every week, they feel like they know you, and you don't know them. So I see, you know, half of the email is just a way of being somebody's friend and giving them fun ideas and teaching them about, you know, the great things you do, and that builds up trust for good reasons. And then yeah, and then we throw all sorts of deals. Then we hit emails all month long. Hey, this is a new release. We're launching our Hello Kitty sticker club, or we're launching our Care Bears collaboration, or you know, check out this this sale on this product, that product. So, you know, half of it is making the person just really excited about the brand. And then the rest, it's easy. Then you can send them any offer, any release, any sale, any drop you want. And people, if they're happy about the brand, are going to buy whatever you put in front of them.
Well said. You mentioned Mo a few times, and I should have asked at the beginning. Mo, I'm assuming is your
Mo
wife.
is Maureen, is my wife. Yeah, sorry.
Is Maureen. Okay. So Mo, she'd probably be the best one to answer this, but I'm sure you can I'm sure you've been able to observe enough that you're qualified to answer this. AI. I know nothing about design. And I went into ChatGPT and I put in 80s design sticker ideas. And it spit out some really good stuff. I don't think I could, well, I know I could not create a sticker empire off of ChatGPT's ideas, but if I was a creative who already had specialized knowledge in what Mo has, I could imagine that it would be a powerful tool. So, like, what impact is AI playing in that side of the business?
Yeah, so you know, it's a scary thing if you're a creative, if you're on the creative team. Like it's a real thing, and we have a large set of number of illustrators and designers and graphic designers and production designers. It's something everybody's thinking about. You know, we have not really incorporated it much into our design process yet, but it has to happen at some point. What I think happens, and take this from a math guy who used to be in finance and now sells stickers.
Sculptors and axes. This is coming from sculptors and axes.
That's right. So what I think happens is, at least in the current iteration or in the iterations that I see, it is going to accelerate and facilitate and speed up that initial ideation process. So, they sit down and they brainstorm over what the June theme is going to be, and then they'll, that's step one. And then step two, people come out, the illustrators design the ideas and they throw them out and they try this and try this and try this and try this. And if it takes, I'm going to make up a number here, let's say it takes an hour for an illustrator to sketch out, a single couple of designs to look at, and they have to do that 8 times, right? Then they're going to get some pool of ideas with which everybody then goes back together, talks and looks at, right? If you're able to shove that portion into a, Midjourney or whatever the AI design process is, instead of getting, 8 designs, you can get 800 designs. At the point that it stands right now, I think that's as far as it goes. So I think it can accelerate that initial idea loop to get you better ideas. But then it still has to go through, there's nothing we've seen yet that can do, can really pick the taste, can pick the styles, can lay the things out properly, can put the things on the sheet correctly. I think it's great for idea generation. But it puts out a lot of bad ideas too. So it's the first part of the process, and it lets you come up with a lot of initial ideas, and then you still need all the designers and illustrators on the back end to make it right.
Man, but isn't that a major part of it? Like the ideation stage of it. What is it? It's better to start with a, it's better to start with a rough draft than a blank page. I don't know if I said that right, but like.
It is for sure. The question is, if can you start with, will the AI be giving you 100 random ideas, or will it be giving you 100 good ideas, right? Like I don't know. I'm not sure where it is. It's to be determined. But I think it accelerates the initial part of the design process. But I don't think it does much, at least right now, to the back end of it.
Amazing. You shared a lot of gold on the show. I truly enjoyed it. Anybody listening to this that I know you're not selling a course or anything behind this. You're just, in the trenches doing it. But in the event there was somebody that was listening to this that was like, man, Carlos is an idiot. I wish he would have asked X question. It would have solved all of the problems in my life. How could somebody drop you a question? What would be the best way for them to do that?
As long as they're not cold calling me and trying to sell me on something, they can email me at nathan@pipsticks.com. That's no problem.
Okay, perfect. I'll drop the email in the description as well. The question I like to ask everyone on the show before wrapping up, though, is what is your favorite book and why?
Favorite book and why, right? So, you mentioned John at BattleBox. I've got a whole network of other, sort of small business owners, e-com owners. And everybody is always talking about, what the latest and greatest small business book and self-improvement book, the book to teach me how to be a better leader, a better manager, how to have better CPAs. And I am pretty confident that I should be reading those books. But by the time it's the end of the day and I've sat down and the kids are finally in bed and I've got like, 12 minutes before I have to go to sleep, I have no interest in that whatsoever. So I tend to read a lot of science fiction. So I would say, I'll give you a series of books instead of one, if that's all right. Is I have recently finished and loved the Ian Banks books, and they're called the culture novels. So that's sort of the universe that they're in. I think the first one, I probably can't pronounce it, is called Consider Phlebas or Phlebas or something like that, Phlebas. But it's Ian M. Banks, and it's the culture novels. I think they're great. They're a lot of fun, but they're like the best kind of science fiction. They're very smart, and they explore, interesting philosophical ideas. So I enjoy that in my 12 minutes before I fall asleep.
I think me, I'm an elementary school dropout, eventually gets a GED. So like this is where it's coming from, right? I think that makes people sharper, like reading those kind of books. Like I feel like I was sharper when I used to have a diet that had my thing was science fiction too. Science fiction and like epic fantasy.
Sure,
It's like
yeah.
Gardens of the Moon, Wheel of Time.
Oh, he's a Steve Erickson fan. There we go. I'm with you.
Yes. Yeah. So like I felt like when my content diet sort of, or the book side of my content diet really consisted of some of that with some of the other business side, it was like almost what I guess sommeliers must do, like when they want to like refresh their taste buds before drinking something else, and it just made me better off for it. So like that's a motivation for me to like pick those books up, because it's been years since I have. So like I appreciate that, and I will check out this novel. One book really doesn't do it for me. Like I want to just binge something.
Yeah, it's a whole series. So if you like these kinds, you'll love it. And I mean, I'm sure I'd get smarter if I read something to teach me about being a better business owner, but I'll be a lot happier, and I'll be a better business owner if I read something that lets me fall asleep and have a better evening. So that's what I do with my books.
Nathan, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it. I learned a bunch from it. I have more energy at the end of the episode than the beginning. So that's why I wanted to do podcasts to begin with. And I'm sure it helped a lot of listeners to the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, it was an honor to be here. Thanks for inviting me, and chatting with you.